welcome friends to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. And as always, thank you for spending your valuable time with me. I really try my best to make sure it's worth your while. And that upbeat little snippet opening the show is called Maria, and it's by a band from across that big pond we call the Atlantic Ocean, and their name is Be Optimistic. And you might recognize this. Well, that's the signal that you're going to hear about what's buzzing around in my bonnet these days. And I got to tell you, it's a real hornet's nest. You know, we have barely 100 days before the next election for president. And I don't know about you, but I'm pretty concerned. We have so many people out there voting their bigotry or having their votes suppressed. We have low-information voters. Not even voting their economic interest. They don't even take time to know the issues, and they end up voting in ways that hurt themselves and average people like themselves and you and me. And, you know, speaking about our band Optimistics from across the pond, I wonder if you've heard yet what really a silly fool Romney is making of himself over in London. They're actually saying he's worse than Sarah Palin and W. That's right, worse than George Bush. You know, it's unthinkable to me the direction things might take if Mitt Romney gets into office. Everything is for sale. Workers and their benefits are expendable. You know, I don't know if you've had time yet to look into the Ryan budget that he supports, but you should know it would help, further destroy the social safety net. It would undermine education, programs for the poor and the middle class, while using more of our tax dollars, yours and mine, for the military budget, which is already exploding and out of control, as we are the policemen of the world. And our tax dollars would go to supplement the rich. Well, you know what they always talk about, the poor always have their hand out. Well, the rich always have their hand out too. It's called social welfare. It's called corporate welfare. You know, within a Mitt Romney presidency, workers and their benefits would be expendable. So, you know, I facetiously wrote on Facebook today that I wouldn't doubt it if there's a secret videotape out there of Mitt Romney and his ilk kneeling down in some sacred ceremony paying homage to their god, the god of predator capitalism, their god embodied in a pot of dollar bills. I don't know about you, but people like him and the big banks, the corporations, the Koch brothers, the Paul Roves and the Dick Cheneys of this world make me feel not only ashamed, but I feel like they're prey. They care nothing for women's rights, worker rights, gay rights. They only care about how to make more money for themselves. You know, it seems like there's almost a plot to turn the country into a third world where average Americans have no decent education, health care, or opportunity, a country where everything's for sale, the air we breathe, the water we drink. Heck, if they pollute the air too much, they'll make money selling us respirators. Well, I'm sick of it. And as I said last week, I'll keep saying it until the election. I hope you're really having a great summer, but I hope you're also paying attention to what's happening in the news. I think we're all being called to be aware, to know the issues, to stand up, to understand who has our back, and to know who doesn't give a care about women in the middle class. We really need to care. We can't have empathy. You know, I was talking to my longtime friend who lives in Louisiana, my home state, and not only the miles have separated us, but our outlook and awareness are on opposite ends of the spectrum, too. She said she was voting for Republicans, but she couldn't really tell me why. She said she just didn't like Obama, but she didn't really know why. I asked her if she knew about the more than 900 bills the Republicans have passed across the United States and all of these states with Republican-led Congress that take away women's reproductive rights, and she said to me, "Why should I care? I'm too old. It won't affect me." Now, you know, this is a caring woman. You know, this is a woman who's not dumb. People, we can't have this kind of apathy. These are our rights being taken away. We have the largest disparity between income and opportunity that we've had in decades. We could seriously end up with a puppet president for millionaires and billionaires in the White House who doesn't invest his money in America. who, when he was governor, he shipped American jobs overseas to India. Who doesn't care about outsourcing jobs if it makes him and his cronies billions? More money than he can ever spend. A guy whose tax returns we can't see and whose emails have conveniently disappeared so we can't look into how he does business. Who doesn't care about women's rights? Who cares solely for the interests of the 1%? You know, Mitt Romney's constituency is not you and me. I hope you're telling your friends they must plan to get out and vote, especially with all the voter suppression Republicans are trying to pull to thwart democracy and deny people more likely to vote for Obama the right to vote. It is truly despicable. There is a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. It's just insane we're still battling to keep contraceptives and our reproductive rights. It's insane we have to have a party blatantly trying to steal the election because they have no good ideas or care about the majority of the American people. Whether it's by stealing votes or buying the Congress and stacking the Supreme Court with right-wing hacks that have enabled 17 old, angry white men to steal democracy away from the people with Citizens United. It's insane we have to constantly fight the Republicans to keep the air and the water clean, to have decent working conditions, to enjoy our constitutional rights. It's insane we're fighting tooth and nail to maintain worker rights, to get equal pay for women. The Republicans would move us back decades. They already have. We can't give up what we fought for. In fact, we need to be like a tsunami in November and wipe the Republicans from office in November, just like the Tea Party did the Democrats in 2010. Only the average Tea Partier got duped. They thought they were getting people in office who cared about creating jobs, and they didn't. All they've been voting for are laws to diminish women's rights. The Tea Party candidates came into office and did nothing but thwart progress for you and me. They wanted the economy to be stagnant to be able to blame Obama. They voted against everything that would have made things better, selfishly, so they could regain the White House and the Senate. If you don't believe me, Google what they've been doing with the filibuster. They're depending on the lies and distortions to win, so please don't let them. Get out and vote in November. Tell your friends to donate what money you can to Democratic candidates, particularly progressive Democrats, not those conservadems or blue dog Democrats. Volunteer at your local election office. Do whatever you can to help, to educate, to get your friends out there, to turn the tide toward evolution, not our regression and hopelessness. Okay, those were the bees buzzing round in my bonnet. If you're new to the show, well, that probably told you a little bit about me. I'm your hostess, Karen Tate. I'm the author of two plain books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Both teach you to lead a goddess-inspired life, whether you're learning about goddess around the world, traveling to her sacred sites, or just want to know about the ideals and values of the sacred feminine and why they're still relevant today. As a matter of fact, quite relevant, more so than a long time, because it would lead us toward a more sustainable future. And tonight we have two wonderful guests. Our first up is Carolyn Shearer. She's the founder of Absolute Love Publishing, and we're going to be talking about her book, Women Will Save the World. Following Carolyn, we have the wonderful scholar Rosemary Radford Ruther with us, and our topic is ecofeminism. We'll discuss the relationship between ecology and theology in religions such as Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and Buddhism. But just a few very quick bits of housekeeping first. I want to invite you to check out my website, KarenTate.com, learn more about my books, classes, Sacred Sunday services, and don't miss the free meditations. They're on my Goddess Store page. They are my gift to you. Also, Pagan Pride Day at the Rainbow Lagoon in Long Beach, California. It has moved its date to October 21st, so if you're in the Southern California area, mark your calendar. An anthology I contributed to is out. It's called Jesus Through Pagan Eyes. It's by Mark Townsend. I contributed a chapter called The Goddess Advocate Talks About Jesus. It might really be of interest to those of you transitioning away from the Abrahamic religions and embracing goddess. And remember, you can catch any show from the archives. You can listen via iTunes as well. And hosts such as myself, we actually pay out of pocket to give our guests a platform to teach and share their wisdom. So if you feel so inclined to send a donation of any amount, please go to the PayPal buttons on my Goddess Store page of my website, KarenTate.com, to help me stay on the air. Because as Goddess ideals teach us, what we nourish, what we tend to thrives, and what we neglect, well, unfortunately, that withers. So without further delay, let me say welcome to Caroline, and thank her for patiently waiting for me through my What's the Buzz segment, sharing those bees buzzing around in my bonnet. Hi, Caroline. Caroline? Oh, wait, let me see. Hey, Caroline, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. You know, you were telling me before we went live that you're having a little problem with your phone. I have never heard so many stories during Mercury retrograde as I have this week of people having problems with their computers, their phones. It feels like this is really an intense Mercury retrograde we're going through right now.
It must be, because I probably called you 20 times and the phone would literally not dial. And
that is so bizarre.
I was like, what's going on?
Well, I'm glad you're here with me now, and I'm sure listeners can hear you. And we will just sort of take this a little slower than usual. And if you can't hear me, just ask me to repeat, and I'll do the same thing.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Well, first, Carolyn, let me start off by giving listeners a little bit of background on you. So, listeners, we have with us Caroline Shearer. She is the founder of Absolute Love Publishing, was born out of a mission to create and publish projects promoting goodness in the world. Known as a fresh, distinctive spiritual voice, Carolyn's visionary leadership is uplifting, gently blending love and inspiration. In addition to Women Will Save the World, Carolyn's other books include Dead End Date, Love Like God, Embracing Unconditional Love, and Raise Your Vibration, Tips and Tools for a High Frequency Life. She also founded Spirited Press, an assisted self-publishing imprint that operates under the umbrella of Absolute Love Publishing. Spirited Press supports authors in sharing their own messages with the world. And her website is womenwillsavetheworld.com and absolutelovepublishing.com. So Carolyn, let's start with your title, Women Will Save the World. Did that have anything to do with the Dalai Lama coming out saying he thought it would be Western women that would save the world?
That is actually the direct inspiration for the book. I stumbled across that quote, and it just stuck with me. And it was one of those times where it just kept coming back into my head over and over. And it got to the point where I just knew that I needed to do something with that quote. And I sat down with my editor and I said, okay, here's a quote and we're going to make a book on it.
Okay.
And that's how the whole project started. I just felt it was a really profound statement. Even to this day, I just find it incredibly profound. And I believe it was something that was worth exploring. And I really, really enjoyed that we were able to do that in this book.
Okay, so what would you say, is the sort of the big picture takeaway from the book? What's the overarching theme aside from women will save the world? You know, how will they do it?
Right. I think what we try to show is that it's our natural place and within our natural abilities that we have the greatest power. And when we are able to step into the traits that we naturally have, we automatically begin to make a difference in the world. And we separated the book into different categories, like creativity and intuition and nurturance. And we break up the essays to show how women can step into those qualities and to give them examples of how other women have done that, both historically and modern. And it basically, I think women are taking from it, this is what I hear, is that by stepping into who they really are and whatever their unique attributes are, they find that they are in a place of power to change the world in whatever way feels right to them. And it's really about honoring that feminine presence, honoring that feminine power, and learning to embrace it and step into it and using that for whatever feels right to us.
Okay. And have any men written essays, as they embrace the sacred feminine within themselves?
You know, we didn't do that. And I thought about it when we first started with the book. And I considered taking men's essays in. But I was just really pleased with what was coming in for the women. And so ultimately, the editorial decision that I made was that we just keep it women. And I think that's good for now. I mean, men are reading the book. But I think right now we're still in a place where most women are still trying to step into embracing their feminine. Men certainly have been on that path too. But I think this book speaks more to the woman trying to step into her feminine and embrace that. And then the men will, of course, follow suit, and then, of course, humanity will follow suit. But we're just one step in a multi-part process.
Sure, of course. Well, of the different women who contributed to the book, I'm curious what their backgrounds were. You know, are they coming at this from a spiritual perspective, a cultural perspective? Is it feminist, or is it just a sort of a rich stew of all different backgrounds?
It's actually quite a diverse group of women, and I really enjoyed watching that unfold. As we were going through the process of choosing essays, it was really interesting to see how almost every different element of the feminine spirit showed up in someone's essay. And so it's quite a wide variety of women. I mean, we have everyone from, you know, former Olympians to super spiritual people, and everything in between, business women. It's very diverse. And I found when I was going through the process of, you know, working with these women in these essays, that in every single essay there was a part of me that was triggered, and there was a part of me that identified with this woman. And, of course, we have so many different parts of us, and so it was really interesting to see how varied I even am as the one putting together this book. And so, for me, it's really complete picture of so many of the different ways that women are in the world and how we interact in the world and how we view the world. So it's actually a very diverse group of women, and I think that really, really adds to the quality of the book.
Well, why don't you tell us a couple of the women's stories, you know, the ones that sort of live at the front of your mind, you know, just sort of a, you know, quick thumbnail sketch.
Sure. Well, Shannon Miller is really interesting. She was the former Olympian. That's very timely, so I'll mention her. She talks about, we have her in the trailblazing section, because she actually has broken all sorts of records within the Olympian field to start within the gymnastics field. So she had already done all of that and trailblazed so wonderfully for women. But then her story actually brings it back to more of the present when she found out that she was diagnosed with cancer. And so we see how she's continuing with that trailblazing mindset into how she's handling the cancer that has come into her life and how she's progressing through it, and how she treated those issues in the same way that she did with the gymnastics. So I think that's a really good quality. Sarah Hackley, the editor of the book, is also one I like to mention because her essay is in the strength category. And I think this is something that so many of us deal with from our mothers. We have learned to view strength as barreling through something and not letting anything bother us. And Sarah reached a certain point in her life where she said, you know what? True strength is allowing myself to be vulnerable, and I need to go ahead and accept these feelings and embrace these feelings so that I can work through them and then move on forward. And so that, I think, is a really powerful example and one that so many of us can identify with our perception of what true strength is as a woman. So those are a couple of the essays. We also have everything from people who ditch their jobs to pursue spirituality or to pursue a home life. It's everything that you can imagine. It's really phenomenal women. I'm absolutely blessed to be a part of the process.
Okay. And so you mentioned a few of the attributes that women sort of embody that you know, that you feel enable women to, you know, be out there and putting that energy in the world to save it. How do you know? Would it maybe name some more of these attributes and you know, tell me if you think they're more or less uniquely, you know, female attributes, maybe ones that you know, hadn't been valued so much in a patriarchal society.
Well, I believe all of them are attributes that everyone has and can embrace. But I do believe women naturally tend to exemplify them more. And the qualities we chose were collaboration, creativity, intuition, nurturance, strength, trailblazing, and wisdom. And, you know, when we first sat down with this book, we did a little bit of the let's see what comes in and let's see what we think are feminine attributes, and we compared, and it was actually really interesting to see how well they came in with these attributes. We didn't necessarily assign all of them to a quality to start with, and it was really interesting how they started naturally falling into these certain categories, and I think that really speaks to the way that we tend to operate in this world. For example, we tend to want to collaborate. I mean, that's just the way that we like to work, like we like to be. And I think that shows up so much in our careers, in our, you know, schools, in our home life. We prefer to collaborate rather than to compete. And so it was really interesting to see how they all started coming in that way. And something like nurturance, of course, is typically viewed as a feminine quality. Of course, men can, you know, exhibit this also. But it's something we tend to naturally do, or I would say more naturally, you know, are drawn to. We want to help others. We want to make a difference. We want to soothe. We want to support. That's just part of what makes us women. In the, you know, how we are right now on this planet, that is part of what makes us women. And so by stepping into that and maybe, you know, not dismissing something that perhaps has been dismissed, you know, earlier on in different times, or most often, I would say, even by ourselves, we learn to really step into that, and then we step into our power. And I will say, you know, I think a lot of these qualities we have been a party to dismissing. You know, for example, with intuition, how often have we said things like, oh, that's just a hunch, or, oh, you know, disregarding something that we're feeling, because we want to believe something's real. And we've all heard friends say things like that. And so I think we're part of the dismissal of it. And this book goes a long way towards encouraging women to accept these parts of themselves and to honor these parts of themselves. And then from there is where it really starts to unfold.
I see. So what do you think is the most important thing a woman can take away from the book?
To honor whoever she is individually. And that is a process for every woman. We all have our different struggles. We all have our different lapses in self-esteem. We all have our different challenges for this lifetime. And we all have the ability to make the most of what we have chosen to do. And so for me, this book is about showing women that it's okay honor whatever is different about themselves or whatever is special about themselves or whatever their passion is or their calling is. It's okay to honor that, and not only is it okay, but it's a beautiful thing, and it's what will enable you to be truly happy and live your passion and make the most impact that you can, which of course is going to lead to even more fulfillment than we can even imagine. And so that's the message of the book. It's to honor ourselves, love ourselves, and really, really step into the beauty of all that's woman.
I'm curious if you found maybe some of the, you know, if you sensed any ambivalence in during this process from women. And let me explain what I mean by that. You know, I find that it seems anyway that there are some women out there who would rather take a back seat, you know, they still sort of have the mentality, I think, of that of my mother's generation, for instance, you know, let the man make the decisions, you know, sort of waiting for that white knight to ride in on their horse and sort of, you know, save them and give them this easy life, you know, sitting in their dream home, being the, you know, maybe they have a nanny and I don't know, they you know, get to spend their time volunteering and, you know, sort of living this sort of charmed life. Did you find any of that? You know, women who really didn't want to step up and either maybe because they were afraid or it was against their religion or, you know, I hate to say it, but maybe in a sense, maybe they didn't want to put out the effort to be a way shower and a change maker.
I haven't come across that, and I think it's because the message of our book doesn't say that you have to go do one specific thing. You don't have to necessarily go, you know, across the world, you know, and save, you know, a million people. The message of the book is more that wherever you are, and whatever path is right for you is where you should be. And that encompasses a wide variety of, you know, of lives. Maybe it is okay for you to live a charmed life and really volunteer, you know, as much as you can and make your difference that way. We all have different paths that we're on in this life, and so I think it's important to remember that what we're learning is different from each other. And so it's important to honor each woman's journey. And I think that's part of the message, too, is not one journey is better than another journey. They're all significant and they're all meaningful. And, you know, that comes back a little bit to, you know, how we can dismiss ourselves. We often dismiss other women, and that's a big part of the problem. We need to honor every woman and every woman's journey and understand that she is learning what she needs to learn and that we're learning what we need to learn. And maybe we already learned what she's learning, and maybe she already learned what we're learning. But that's okay. That's part of our life path. That's part of our process. And so whatever it is that we're doing that feels right to us is exactly what our soul needs. And it brings it back to that soul level, because we want to get caught up sometimes in the ego level, and, you know, that's where some of those traps can come in, you know, where we get complacent. But when we step into that soul level and say, this is what my soul wants, it's hard to find anyone who doesn't actually step into that in their own way. They may have conflicts in their mind. They may have some ego issues going on. But this book is about saying whatever feels right to you on your feminine journey is honorable, and we respect that, and you should respect that. And it's part of what makes us so wonderful as women, and it's part of how we are going to change the world is honoring each of those different journeys. So I can't say that I've come across anyone complacent. You know, I don't even know who I would describe as complacent. I'm not sure there's a woman I could describe as complacent, because I think every woman is doing something for her life in her way that is best for her. So
okay.
I'm not sure if that answers your question.
No, but I understand where you're coming from, and I think your point was very valuable. You know, that we're all on different parts of the journey, and we should all be respected and where we are on that journey valued, and you know we can learn from each other.
Well, and the complacency thing is one question, and I've also been asked, well, does this intimidate women that we're saying that they should save the world? And I think they're semi-related, because it comes down to, you know, we're not saying you need to go do something big and dramatic. It is wonderful if you do, and we cheer you on. And if that's what's right for you, then that's excellent. And you may be making a medium impact, or you may be making a small impact, but whatever impact you're making is worthwhile and valuable. And so we also don't get the people who, once they've read the book, they're not thinking, oh my gosh, how am I going to save the world? And I think that's why this book is so empowering, is because it's not saying you need to go do something that you think is unattainable. It's saying you need to do whatever feels right to you. And I think that's really valuable, and I think that's part of our our diminished self-esteem that we seem to have come into this world with. So many women have this minimized self-esteem. And this is part of building that back up and saying you are valuable, you do have a contribution to make. It is whatever you feel it is. And I just think that's so valuable in this world right now. We really need to honor who we are and love who we are.
Okay. Well, now when you, I'm interested in your process. How did you determine, how did you put out the call? Was it women you knew, or was it sort of just a, you know, you cast your net wide? I mean, how did you find the women that ultimately got chosen to put their essays in the book?
Yeah, we had just finished another compilation on unconditional love, and it was called Love Like God. And so we had made a lot of connections with people and businesses and publicists, and we started there, is just reaching out to our current contacts and saying, hey, we have a new book coming out. We're looking for people to participate in it. This is the main theme. It's celebrating the feminine nature. And it was really, really easy, I have to say. And just like Love Like God was, it was incredibly easy, and it was just something how I knew it was supposed to happen, because it was unfolding right before my eyes, you know, how easily it was to attract the women to the book. And thankfully, there is no shortage of fantastic women out there. We probably could have made a book five times as long without too much trouble. But we started there, and we also used some journalist resources, and we always allow publicists and people to contact us through our website that we kind of keep an ongoing role of for potential projects. So it was actually pretty easy. There are just a lot of really fantastic women. So
okay.
You know, that's something I'm obviously grateful for.
Well, now you, I know you believe that it's important for women to get in touch with their inherent feminine qualities. I guess I'm wondering, you know, since, we're living in this patriarchal paradigm, and I wonder if some women weren't even aware of what their, you know, quote, feminine qualities were.
You know, I think there is a little bit to that. You know, I think because some of these qualities have been, well, probably all of them have been undervalued at some point or another. And this does introduce women to those, and it may help some women learn to identify those qualities and step into them. I'm lucky, I guess. I haven't had to deal too much. In fact, I can't say that I've really ever had to deal with feeling repressed or anything like that. In my lifetime, I'm pretty young. I don't know if that affects it, but it will help women who are having trouble saying, "Hey, this is part of me and it's valuable." But I also think it's good. I'm finding a lot of younger girls are reading it. You know, like even high schoolers and in college age and women in their 20s. I'm finding it's especially valuable for because they still have all this still in front of them. And if, you know, imagine if we knew what we knew back when we were that age and how rapidly that's going to help, you know, the evolution of who women are on this planet and how we can affect other people. So that's all part of the process. I think it is valuable because we may say, hey, you know, I didn't realize intuition was valuable, or I didn't realize my natural, you know, nurturing quality was valuable, and hey, you know what it is, you know, I don't need to, you know, minimize it or push it aside or put it in the corner.
So I'm wondering if any of your essayists associated their feminine qualities, their empowerment, did any of them connect it to knowing about the sacred feminine or any particular goddesses or anything like that?
Some of the women mentioned those kinds of things, and we didn't put any limits on that. We didn't say, you know, you need to refer to your religion or your spirituality, whether you're New Age or classical Christian. We kind of just let it happen to see how it unfolded, and it turned out to be a pretty good mix. We do have some women who mentioned a lot of, I don't like the term New Age, but I am, I guess, New Age, but I don't really like the term. But there are threads of that, certainly, and there are also threads of, you know, Christianity. It's a lot of different stuff, and they're just more woven. I would say it's subtle. It's more about the feminine experience, and then those are naturally part of that experience.
Is there anything in the book that sort of relates to the masculine or women's relationship with men?
We don't go too much into the masculine. We do have at the back, we have extra stuff other than the essays too. And I did put in ways to find balance in the feminine because I think we can swing too feminine or too masculine, and I think it's important to have a good balance, just as it is for men to have a good balance. So we address it from that angle. We don't really have any women talking about, you know, what it's like to embrace her masculine side. It's more about the feminine, and I think that's because that's where we mainly are as a society. We kind of already know what the masculine way is, and so this is more about stepping into the feminine part of it.
Okay. And so ways to celebrate the feminine. Can you give us some examples, maybe the top five?
Sure. I'll just randomly read a few. I'll see what comes. Oh, actually, the first one my eye went to was allow men to celebrate their masculine. So there you go. We do, because I think men, you know, have as much. You could write a whole book on what men have too. So that's the first one. Allow men to celebrate their masculine. Another one is make it a priority to find women who will support you unconditionally and spend time with them on a regular basis. Exhale and allow yourself to be confident and secure in the wisdom of your womanhood. Appreciate that nature creates just as women do, and make efforts to spend more time in it. Exercise in ways that feel comforting and supportive of your beautiful womanly body. Appreciate the menstrual cycle as a time for reflection, renewal, and self-nurturance. And let's see, I'll do one more. Compliment yourself when you look in the mirror, and I think that's a big one for women.
Yeah, we have so many negative messages. You know, you think about the millions of dollars, you know, women feel like they have to spend with cosmetic surgeons or on diets, and it is really hard for us to accept ourselves as beautiful when, you know, we have these unrealistic levels, of beauty to achieve. You know, if we're thinking of runway models, you know, so many of those are, you know, have the body of a young boy. So, would you offer any quick tips for listeners after, put the book together and, you know, reading what all the women had to say? I mean, do some things jump out at you?
Yes. I think it's important that, you know, we kind of discussed this, but I want to come back to it because I just think it's so important that we honor ourselves. And that's where it comes from, is honoring ourselves and loving ourselves. And if there is a part of us that we feel is weak or that we feel isn't, you know, beautiful enough to show to the world, that we're not confident with, that is wonderful because we know what it is and we can send love to it. And once we can send love to it, we can heal it and then we can grow from there. And so when you have your weaknesses, thank the universe that you know what they are. And that way you can work on them. And then we can step more fully into who we are. And when we're loving ourselves unconditionally and completely, you know, through every circumstance, through every word, through every thought, through every action, then we can celebrate the wholeness of our feminine being. And so I think that's what it really comes down to, is loving ourselves and honoring ourselves.
Okay. And I know you probably have a lot of powerful stories in the book, but if you had to pick one that was maybe the most, the one that influenced you the most, or maybe the one you get the most feedback on, is there one such story?
You know, I get asked that a lot, and you're going to say I'm being politically correct by not answering it, but that's not, it's just there. I love them all. And when I said, you know, I identify with each one of the essays, I really mean that. I mean, there is something in every single essay that speaks to me as a woman. And as I went through the process, I grew. I'm a different woman today than I am when I started this process. And each one hits on something a little bit different. And we also have historical women mixed in with the book, you know, that go with each of the different categories. So you can see how these traditionally feminine attributes have impacted the world in big ways.
Like, and why don't you give an example of that? Because we have a little bit of time here.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, Mother Teresa, obviously, everyone loves Mother Teresa and what she did. And we have her in the nurturing category. We also have Harriet Tubman. We have the founders of the Girl Scouts and of the Junior League, because those are both big collaborative efforts. And then we have some really interesting women in the intuition category. We have St. Teresa of Avila and Hildegard. And we have two for each of the categories. And I think that adds a really nice way for women to see, hey, maybe my contribution is smaller, but I see how these women who also thought their contributions were small ended up having really powerful impacts. Because most of these women, I mean, they didn't go out to say, hey, let's change the world. They were just doing what felt right to them and what was coming from their center of power and what was coming from their natural ability. And so it's a really, I find, inspirational contrast to see a modern woman, you know, acting on, for example, her strength, and then to see an historical woman living her strength and how we can transition from that small impact to that larger impact.
Interesting. And I'm thinking about Hildegard. You know, women like her lived in a time when, you know, I'm surprised Hildegard wasn't burned at the stake, you know, for you know, some of the things, you know, she talked about and believed. And but yet, like you said, you know, she just followed what felt right to her. And it would really be interesting to know what she thought about her, you know, if she even had a sense of her role in the world, you know, at the time she was living her life. I think a lot of us women, you know, we minimize our contribution. You know, we don't really see the value of our contributions all the time. And I don't know, you know, maybe sometimes that could be a double-edged sword, you know, it could be a good thing and a bad thing.
Well, it's really interesting you bring that up, because we found that with almost all of the women, Hildegard included, they really doubted themselves a lot. And I think that's part of what can help us now, because, you know, we have that same doubt, and to see that a woman lived through that doubt, but kept going and kept doing what felt right through that doubt, and then had so much impact. I mean, that's really powerful stuff. That's the kind of stuff that can make us see, hey, you know, there's some validity to this. And, you know, Mother Teresa was one of the biggest self-doubters, I have to say. And look at what she did. I mean,
really? I didn't realize she was a self-doubter.
Oh my gosh. She didn't find herself worthy. She had extreme self-doubt. And it was almost like that not feeling valuable is what drove her to want to help more people. You know, it's almost like there's this hidden part of herself that was saying, she wasn't saying she needed to prove herself valuable. But from a feminine aspect, there is that little bit of, you know, we tend to act out of our weakness sometimes, and we tend to compensate for it. And, you know, that's actually a good thing a lot of the time, because we're able to create, you know, something good from it. And she had some of her reading a lot about her, and it was just pages and pages of how much she doubted herself, and how she felt she wasn't worthy. And, you know, it's just amazing to me. And so many of the women experienced that, and yet they went through it, and they marched through it, and they made their contribution. And I just find that so valuable to know that. I think it's part of us identifying with that feeling of, you know, what impact can I make? Well, you know, who am I? What can I do? Well,
yeah.
We're all in that same place.
No, I will admit that too. I mean, you know, there are lots of times I'll say, you know, say to my girlfriends, or I'll say to somebody, you know, oh gee, I don't think what I'm doing is making a difference. You know, I'm not really contributing enough. And they'll say, oh, are you kidding? You know, but we never see it. You know, we never feel like we're good enough. We never feel like we're doing enough. That we don't see how other people see it, I think. You know, I think we're probably our worst critics. And it's wonderful that Mother Teresa had laid bare her soul, you know, her vulnerability, like you said, that enabled other women to see inside her psyche, you know, so that they could relate. And did you find that there was anything in particular that maybe helped women who doubted themselves? What it was that kept them going even when they weren't sure themselves that they were on the right path or making a difference or whatever doubt it was they had?
It's hard to come up for a word for it, but it has to be faith. It has to be some kind of faith, or maybe hope, or maybe a mixture, or maybe a word that we don't know yet. But it was something along those lines that seemed to really propel them to continue to act through all of this self-doubt.
As if it was a calling or something, huh?
A lot of them did feel they had a calling, but a lot of them were just doing what they were doing. I mean,
yeah.
some of them weren't even thinking too big picture. They were just saying, well, this is the moment and this is the opportunity and I'm going to do it. And then, of course, by the time you're done with the life, there's all these, you know, now moments that are now over that end up, you know, amounting to something fantastic. But at the time, you were just taking it one moment at a time. And that was different for the women. But, you know, for a lot of them, it seems to be faith in something bigger. And hope, I think, was part of that. You know, it's hard to say, you know, what keeps us going. I mean, that's the big picture question. You know, what is it that we're part of? You know, why are we driven to be good and evolve? And, you know, of course, I believe that comes down to our, you know, why we're here on the planet is to evolve our souls. And I think we have this continual pull to make ourselves better and purer and more loving. And but it's different for all the women. And there just seems to be this force, this energy that propelled them forward and that thankfully is propelling us forward in our own ways.
So if you had a friend who maybe was suffering from, oh, you know, self-doubt or, you know, maybe wasn't happy with her life, or do you think this she would, you know, find this book uplifting and inspirational?
I definitely think that. And that's what I hope women are taking from it. And that is so far what I'm hearing women are taking from it. Because we need to heal that self-doubt and we need to love ourselves. And this is a step. I mean, this isn't going to fix every problem for every person, but it's part of the process. It's part of healing the feminine psyche. And, you know, this will show women there's value to you. And, you know, hopefully you're hearing it from 100 other places at the same time. But this is part of it, and it can really help. And it can help you understand that there's value to you, there's value to every part of you, there's value to everything you do and everything you say and everything you see, you know, you speak and think. And I find that, you know, tremendously encouraging that we have this and that we have, you know, whoever else is in our lives that is supporting us in that way, because we will be fulfilled when we are able to step into who we are, and we will be happy and we will be living a different life once we are able to accept and honor all of that.
Well, it sounds like this was a pretty powerful experience for you as well, Carolyn. What would you say, you know, how would you say the book changed you?
In all of those ways and many more, I just feel more in touch with myself, with my feminine self. I think I'm on the same journey as so many of us, where I've had my doubts, I've had my lapses in self-esteem, I have my little places that need more love, and this has helped me learn to take care of those and learn to nurture myself. You know, so often we want to nurture other people and help others' problems, and that's great, but we can also step into nurturing ourselves. And that has been a big process for me, is learning to take care of me and honor me, and not necessarily putting everything else and everyone else before that. And I think for me that was the most valuable thing, is learning to, you know, it's not that I didn't respect myself, it's not that I didn't love myself. You know, I mean, I was, you know, I thought in a pretty good place, but actually I realized how much more I had to, you know, or I was able to evolve, and how much more nurturing I could be and how much more loving I could be. And it brings me to a place of a pretty good calm. I mean, I'm calm, I'm peaceful, I feel happier. I feel more at peace with who I am as a woman. I don't feel that I need to prove things, or people, you know, don't need to agree with me or think what I think. Or it brings you to a place of being really secure. And I think that's how it's impacted me, is being really secure in who I am as a woman.
Well, that's incredibly valuable.
Absolutely.
So, well, now also I understand that the book also gave women tips on how to focus channeling feminine receptivity and magnetizing things they want. Could you speak to that a little bit? Because we have about 10 minutes left.
Sure. Well, you know, I think that's part of this, is, you know, the masculine way of getting things is to go get them and to make them happen. And the feminine way is more about the creativity process, or about the allowing process. And so this book touches on how we can, you know, relax into who we are, and instead of feeling like we need to go make something happen, we are able to allow our highest and greatest good to unfold before us. And that's a pretty powerful shift, because I mean, we've all gone after something before. But it's so much nicer to sit back and relax and let it happen. It's just great.
Well, you know, I love what you're saying, but you're sort of talking in theory. Could you give an example of a scenario where, you know, doing this is going out to get it, where if you instead take these actions, it's more using your creativity and allowing?
Sure. Actually, a couple of the stories were women who were in very successful careers and were making lots of money and were very esteemed by their colleagues, and, you know, just in the general way that we perceive to be these days with success. And a couple of them, in fact, maybe even more than a couple, just stopped, and they quit their jobs. And they took time for themselves, and, you know, one of them was living off credit cards and had a child at home, and everyone thought she was crazy. But she sat on her floor with her stones and her angel cards, and she meditated, and she, you know, took the time to discover who she really was underneath all of the outer trappings that she had been taught were what she was supposed to do. And it's a similar story with other women who just decided, I'm going to get off this treadmill. I'm done. I'm going to stop, and I'm going to listen to my heart, and I'm going to find what it is. Sorry.
Okay.
I found a stray dog a week ago. I did. He found me at the library of all places. Okay. It's okay. Sorry.
That's okay. We all have lives.
Well, no, it's an interesting story, because I'm not a dog person per se. Like, I never thought of myself that way. And then here this dog literally hops in my car. So I guess now I am a dog person. Maybe that's part of me embracing something feminine or masculine. We'll find out. But it's part of, I think a big part of that is listening to our heart. And, you know, a lot of women had to completely step away from their lives, you know, for that. Some ended marriages, some stayed in the marriages but left jobs. It's whatever is right for each individual person. But I think a lot of it is coming back home, coming back to our heart center, and coming back to finding what it is that we're saying inside, like listening to what it is that's coming from us rather than from the outside world.
So I'm curious, just as an example, the woman who just quit her job and, you know, she, you said she meditated and she used her angel cards and, you know, what? How did her life change? I mean, how did she, when she shifted gears into something else, what was the new her?
She is actually doing wonderfully now and has learned to take that feminine side of herself. And she's using it to support other women. I'm talking about Amethyst Wildfire, by the way, for anyone who's picking up the book. She really stepped into honoring that path. And now she actually helps other people who are on that kind of similar path, and she helps them learn to step into their own, I guess, spiritual power, but in a place of business. So she kind of combined her skills from the business with her spiritual beliefs. And
okay.
She represents a lot of clients that way.
So almost like a, you know, maybe almost a life coach or something.
Yes, in a way. And it expands to like the media and things like that with, in her case. But there are so many ways that we can translate that into what applies best for our life. That was the right path for her. But maybe for someone else, it's starting a business that is heart-centered or that feels right to you, or maybe it's becoming an author, or maybe, you know, it's volunteering, you know, whatever it is that feels right for each person, that's honoring her own heart.
Okay. All right. Well, we still have a couple minutes before my second guest is scheduled to call in. Is there anything I haven't asked you, Caroline, that you want to make sure listeners, you know, come away with?
Well, you know, what I like to say is with Absolute Love Publishing, I feel like everything I create comes down to love, and I feel like that's the big theme of my life, and I have personally worked through a lot of the issues with love. It seems like almost everything I go through in life, you know, my challenges, they all seem to have something to do with love, and of course, being a publisher, I get to work it out in a public way through books. But I think that's important for us to remember. We do want to learn about, you know, women, and we do want to learn about unconditional love, and we do want to learn about, you know, business or politics or health or whatever. But all of it, I think, at its core, if you were to, you know, pare it down, would come down to love. And I think that's a really good message for everyone to just kind of think about and say, you know, whenever they're facing a particular challenge, say, well, what does this have to do with love? And how can I love to make the situation better? And I feel like that's my life calling, and I may express it in lots of different ways, like with this book, but I'm really blessed to be able to express this love in different ways. And I, you know, I feel really thankful. I'm in a great place where I just feel really thankful to be on the path that I'm on. I'm thankful to be on this show. I'm thankful to be doing what I'm doing. And it's because I've been listening to my own intuition and my own passion, and every woman and every man can feel that way. It just takes that courage and that ability to step through that fear.
Okay. Well, and I'm wondering about your publishing company. For any of the listeners out there who might be interested, do you take proposals or you know, from, you know, people who send them in to you, or is that not the way you choose what books you're going to publish?
We have two different options. Absolute Love Publishing, we operate somewhat as a traditional publisher. People can submit through that, but we're extremely, extremely selective with what we do through that. We also have Spirited Press, which is an imprint of Absolute Love Publishing, and that is for people who want to do a hybrid of the self-publishing versus traditional. And this is great for a lot of people because they get to keep their rights, and we handle a lot of the work. So it's a good mix, and, you know, we offer editing services, and we can get your cover done and all those good kind, you know, all those kinds of things. There's so much to publishing. Anyone is capable of it these days because of the technology, but there's just so much to it that it really is helpful to have someone on your side. And so that's what Spirited Press is for. And anyone who's interested in that can go to our website. They can actually go to spiritedpress.com. or just absolutelovepublishing.com and contact us through that for information.
Okay. And now you sounded really well through the whole interview, but when you described Absolute Love Publishing, you said that one was a little bit different than Spirited Press. That one, it sounded like you might have said you don't really take proposals for that one. Was that correct? I couldn't quite catch the words you said.
We do accept them, but we're very, very selective with Absolute Love Publishing. Yeah. We're very selective with that because we're really trying to keep our message on point. And, you know, maybe a couple of years from now we can veer more away from that. But right now we're really, really focused on the mission, which is creating goodness in the world. And so, it's, you know, you can still submit, and we definitely consider everything that comes through.
All right. And so Spirited Press, is that more e-books, or you also end up with hardcover books as well?
We can do either one. We can do the books, or we can do the ebooks. And actually, we bought the name Mini Book, and we've trademarked it. And that's a pretty good package for someone, for example, who wants to be an expert in their field or something like that. Instead of having a whole full-length book, it's a mini book. And it is e-based, and they're 15,000 words or less. And that's a really great way for people to kind of dip their toe in and see if this is something they want to do, or else just add a little bit of credibility to what they're already doing.
Okay. And how? And I would imagine if you or somebody with Spirited Press, do you also, you know, do they rely on you to help them market the book, or are they totally on their own in terms of telling the world about their, you know, their work?
It's a la carte. And I did that on purpose because I like options. And so I want to provide options. And so they get to choose exactly what they want and what they maybe they don't need, because maybe they have time to work on a certain area, but they don't for another one. And so everything is a la carte. You can choose anything from editorial to design to layout to marketing and public relations.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Caroline, it has been fun talking to you tonight, and don't worry in the least. I'm sure listeners heard you just fine, and we only have to live through this Mercury retrograde, I think, until the 8th of August. Let's hope tonight's technical difficulties were the last you'll experience this time round in Mercury retrograde.
Oh my, was it interesting? But I'm glad it worked out.
I'm sure glad it did too. So thank you for calling in, and listeners, you have just heard me chatting with Caroline Shearer of Absolute Love Publishing, talking about all of the women in her book who are doing their part to help save the world. Thank you so much, Carolyn, for being on the show tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listeners, we have Rosemary Radford Ruther up on the show, and I see she's on the switchboard, and I'm going to be saying hello to her in just a second. But just a little intro. You know, I've been wanting to have her on the show as a guest for some time. She has some great articles on the web. She has one on creation spirituality. There was another one called What is Feminism and Why We Should Do It, Women's Reproductive Rights in the Catholic Church, and so many great books. Two that jumped out at me, and I think they'll be of interest to you, are Gaia and God, Ecofeminist Theory of Earth Healing. There's also Goddesses and the Divine Feminine, A Western Religious History, Sex. Then there's Sexism and God Talk Toward a Feminist Theology. So you can imagine, after myself presenting a paper to the American Academy of Religion titled The Politics of Ecofeminist Spirituality, A Theology for a Sustainable Future, I guess you could call it AKA Goddess as a Democrat. It's kind of more mainstream, less academic title. Well, I was certainly interested in talking to Rosemary and learning what I could about her take on ecofeminism. So that is actually what our chat is going to be about tonight. But maybe if I do a good job and she has some fun, maybe she will come back on the show and talk to us about some of her other books. So, Rosemary, are you there?
I am. Very happy to be on the show.
Well, thank you so much. I am so happy to have you. You know, really, when I contacted you, I was really, you know, it was like I felt like a kid in the candy store because there were so many things we could have talked about, so much interesting stuff. And I've actually gotten a number of people who sent me email questions for you. But if that's okay, maybe we can get to those after we talk about ecofeminism.
Okay.
So let's start at the top. You know, maybe just start with the very basics. You know, what is ecology?
Well, basically, I mean, in its roots, ecology is a biological science. It's a biological science of environmental systems. In other words, not particular plants or animals, but whole systems of environment and how they interconnect and interdepend on each other. So that's what ecology means as a science, but it's become popularized as a term sort of for environmentalism in general.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's probably what most of us think about, you know, and there's all different sorts of ecology. I mean, there's human ecology, you know, how we relate to one another. There's, ecosystems, you know, how different organisms in an ecosystem rely on one another. So really there's all, you could talk about all different sorts of ecology, couldn't you?
Right.
Okay. So what we're going to talk about tonight is how ecology and feminism, how they relate. So tell us about it.
Okay. Well, basically, the idea that there's a connection between ecology and feminism has been growing in the past decade, and it basically means not that they're identical by any means, but rather that there's an interconnection, and particularly that the kind of imagery and social structures by which societies have dominated women have sort of interacted with the way they have dominated nature. And sometimes nature has been given sort of imagery like women. You know, we talk about the rape of nature and so on like that. So that there is this kind of interrelationship between the domination of women and the domination of nature. So that's basically what that's about.
Well, Rosemary, and please, at any time, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm here to learn just like my listeners are. But I wonder if part of this doesn't go back to, you know, the Bible verse in Genesis that so many people interpret to mean that, you know, you have God at the top, then you have man, and man is entitled to rule over women, the earth, and everything on it.
Yeah, well, I think that scholars, historians of Western thought, Lynn White, for example, did a famous article on this in 1967, have seen this idea of dominion, but specifically males have been given a kind of dominion over nature, and that they therefore sort of supplant God or represent God in dominion over nature. And that has been seen as sort of the root of the ecological problem, is that concept of dominion. Now, what biblical scholars would say is that that's really a simplification and misreading of the Bible, and it's not so much that that's the only thing the Bible says as it is that particular verse has been lifted up and sort of exploited.
Well, but we know that happens all the time. I mean, if God says it's so, you can justify just about any goddarn thing.
Right.
So, well, do you sort of agree with that? I mean, do you think that's, I don't know, is it a convenient excuse for male privilege or patriarchy to thrive?
Well, I think what feminism in Christianity as well as other religions are concerned about is to lift up the diversity of the religious traditions, that there are patterns in it that have justified patriarchy and male domination and have given people the popular image of God as a patriarchal male, but there are other resources that are contrary to that. And so it's possible to kind of reform these traditions by pulling aside these partial views and lifting up others that are more perhaps more essential.
Well, and you're saying that. Let me throw out an example to you that I think about, and maybe you have others. And if there's a flaw in my thinking, tell me. I think about the goddess myth of the Inuit goddess Sedna. And, you know, she's sort of I think of her as the environmental goddess, so to speak. You know, here she's sort of the gatekeeper. She lives in the watery depths off Newfoundland. You know, she's kind of the gatekeeper there. If man gets greedy and uses more of the animals in his environment than he needs for food, clothing, tools, whatever, then she can cut him off. Also, there, you know, some of her myths talk about, you know, pollution. They aren't to pollute. And if mankind, humankind, you know, doesn't do what's right, well, you know, she can make him suffer. You know, she can make him hungry. She can, you know, hold the animals back from him, and he'll not have what he needs. Are you talking about, as an example, a myth like that that would sort of be a teacher to humanity, you know, to act differently in the world?
Oh, very much so. In other words, I think that part of what ecology and feminism are doing is really looking at the larger framework of human culture, really, and to show resources for really caring for nature rather than exploiting it.
Okay. And, well, what were some of the examples you were thinking of? You said if we had a different, well, I forgot the word you used, but I think if we had different stories, because we know our mythology sort of ends up becoming how we structure society. So what other stories could we tap into that might make humankind think differently about how we behave?
Within the scriptural tradition itself, you have the idea that humanity is really to care for nature, that stewardship is one of care for nature, not exploitation. So there's ways of reading these traditions differently than simply the idea that man, i.e., the ruling class male, has been given sort of carte blanche to do anything they want with nature.
Okay. Well, now, what about some of the other religions? Where does ecology fit into religions like Islam or Judaism or Buddhism?
Well, I think there's an interest in ecology across the religious traditions. I think some of the patterns that have mandated domination of nature, and even the idea that God is a god of history and is sort of hostile to the gods of nature, is also found in Judaism. Christianity inherits those kinds of patterns. There's really less of that in Islam and very little in Buddhism, in my view. And partly also in Buddhism, you do not have an anthropomorphic deity to begin with.
Right. Okay. Did I just understand you to say that idea of sort of demonizing nature or dominating nature is more prevalent in, well, I guess Christianity and Judaism, because, well, they come from the same book.
Right. Yeah, I think there's more roots of it in that. And so I think they need to grapple with this problem.
Okay. So where does, I've never really thought to research this. Where does, say, for instance, the Vatican stand on this sort of thing? Do they have a position?
Actually, the Vatican is fairly involved in ecological issues. I mean, they were slow to do that, but recently they really have taken a major hand in really recruiting concern for the care for the earth and so on. The Vatican's problem is that they are unable to really deal with the population problem because of their attitudes toward birth control. So they find limitations or sort of blocks in being able to say anything because of their attitudes toward sexuality and reproduction. And yet they have tried to talk about the need for care for the earth.
So it would be good for the earth if we had less people, but they don't want to promote birth control.
Right.
Got it.
Well,
okay.
what
a conundrum.
What they really don't want to do is allow people to have sex without procreation.
Ah, okay.
I mean, they'd be fine if everybody just didn't have any sex at all, but that's not the way humans are constituted.
Right. and I'm not even sure they want humans to have sex with themselves either. That's a sin,
right.
Too, I think.
Of course.
So now, the idea of ecofeminism, when or where did it develop? I mean, where did we first start hearing about it?
You have to kind of distinguish between the term and the idea that there's an interconnection of ecology and feminism. The term itself seems to have been coined in France about 1972 by a group that talked about they spoke of themselves as a group for ecology and ecofeminism. And so that word has been used broadly, but then there's other literature that simply talks about the problem of the domination of nature and how that's been related to issues of feminism.
So if you had to define ecofeminism, what would you say it is?
Well, I would say ecofeminism is simply a kind of symbol or term for this relationship of ecology and feminism. That's all.
Okay, but it goes to the idea that you don't want either one to be dominated. So it's for the liberation of women and I'm trying to think of the right words. That's not exactly right. But it's so that neither women or the earth are dominated.
Yeah, the flourishing of nature and the flourishing of women is equals with men in society, something like that.
Yeah, sort of, or almost, an egalitarian world where men, women, and the earth all are equal.
Right. Well, obviously, the earth is a kind of complicated term.
True. We're sort of being oversimplistic here, but I think listeners probably get the gist.
Right.
So do we find ecofeminism internationally or cross-culturally?
Yeah, it's very much become a cross-cultural term. For example, there are major thinkers in India like Vandana Shiva, and she actually uses the term ecofeminism. She's written a book with a German feminist called Ecofeminism in 1993 already, and you have a Brazilian woman, Ivone Gabara, who's adopted this term, ecofeminism, and there's African women who don't necessarily use the term but talk about the relationship of feminism and ecology and so on. So I would say it's become very much an international term.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, Rosemary, and I don't know if you know, but if someone felt this was important, what groups, say let's keep it to the United States, what groups should they support? What groups are most in line with the ideals that are in sync with ecofeminism?
Well, I think you have to look at the various dimensions of that because there's obviously a certain kind of discourse going on in terms of religion to kind of criticize feminism. Both the domination of women by the church and also the the neglect of ecology, and you have people talking about that in sort of symbolic theological terms, but they're not necessarily doing a lot
right.
in terms of practice.
Yeah, just
so
a lot of talking heads.
One has to really look at if we're better care for the earth is going on in terms of practice.
I mean, do you have any thoughts on the Green Party? It's almost as if any party that's not one of the major two, well, they don't really sort of stand a snowball's chance in hell of, you know, winning. But, would that be a place to sort of plant your flag?
Well, I'm very sympathetic to Green parties, both here and abroad. I mean, there's a strong Green Party in Germany, for example, and so on. And they tend to also be sympathetic to the problems of feminism as well. So I think they're strong Green parties. The American Green Party, I think, has, in my view, some of the best principles. It's yet to become, you know, get the sort of money and power to be a strong political contender, but I think it has very good principles if you look at what they stand for.
Do you have any thoughts on what it would take for the Green Party to gain more power?
I mean, our political parties are, you know, the two dominant political parties are so tied in with big money, with corporate funding and so on and so on. And that's, I think, a major reason why they don't, in fact, endorse anything that's particularly useful. I mean, just think of this recent gun massacre, and yet neither political candidate has been able to say anything about gun control of almost, well, Barack Obama has now said something slight, but but when you think that people simply have an open field, I mean, this guy was getting 50 packages of munitions and bombs and assault weapons and so on, and yet there's no critique of that at all.
Right, right. Well, we would have to have some real campaign finance reform, and, you know, so that corporations who it's in their interest to exploit the environment, just like it is in their interest to exploit women, you know.
Right.
You know, we would have to get, you know, somehow, you know, make it so that lobbyists and corporations didn't have so much control, then maybe a party like the Green Party, or even, heaven forbid, an eco-feminist party, you know, could maybe rise up and actually, you know, have a little bit of influence.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that our political options are disastrous.
True. Very true. Well, so Rosemary, getting back to your books, your two books that talk about ecofeminism are Gaia and God and Ecofeminism, Globalization, and World Religions. How are the two books different? I mean, if my listeners wanted to choose between these books, what's the distinction between the two, you know, to maybe help them choose?
Well, Gaia and God is in 1992. It's a much older book, and I would say it's more of a kind of systematics. That is to say, it goes through these issues of feminism and ecology and so on, in terms of a kind of systematic looking at the doctrine of creation, destruction, good and evil, healing, and so on. So it has more of that framework of being a more of a theoretical systematics, whereas the integrating ecology, ecofeminism, globalization, world religions is much more of a series of essays. And it's 2005, so it's more than 10 years later, and it kind of goes through sort of the issues of how the world is being impoverished, and what we need to do to overcome that, But it also has some chapters kind of on the greening of world religions and major ecofeminist leaders around the world and so on. So I would say it's more sort of more topical and more recent.
So do you have reason to be optimistic or pessimistic?
I sometimes like to say that I don't do optimism or pessimism, because optimism sort of suggests that everything's going to take care of itself, so you don't have to do much. And pessimism suggests that it's useless, so it's also not necessary to do anything.
So what's the middle road?
And so I think we really need to have a kind of commitment to try to really continually talk about the issues and continually try to find ways to do some changes here and there. I think one needs to have that kind of commitment, whether things are going well or not going well, perhaps even more if they're not going well.
Okay. Well, and you sort of, threw out a phrase a moment ago when you were describing the essays and the ecofeminism, globalization, and world religions. I think you said the greening of governments. Is that what you said?
No, I said the greening of world religions.
Greening of world religions. Speak to that a little bit. What do you mean?
Well, about more than 10 years ago, there was a project in which each of the major world religions, this was, I think, 96 to 98, each of the world religions, 10 world religions, and that means Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Taoism, Confucianism, and so on. You know, there were 10 big conferences in which each of these world religions committed themselves to really examining its positive resources for ecology and some of the problems where it was not helpful. And so you have this, that's what I call the green world religions. It's this big study, and then each of these religions, these conferences were translated into major books, and then now there's an ongoing forum that's based at Yale University in which all of these world religions work together to try to dialogue with each other and with science and technology to try to promote better ecological relations through lifting up the resources of their religious traditions. And so that chapter really talks about how all those, that process.
I'm just wondering, now years later, did they do anything worthwhile?
I think they're continually doing things worthwhile, but I think still my problem is a lot of this discussion about religion and ecology tends to go on the level of sort of theological symbolism.
Rather than actual on-the-ground progress.
Rather than really getting to on-the-ground action.
I see. So it's sort of just tinkering around the edges. It's just a bunch of talking heads talking to one another.
Well, that's what theologians tend to do.
Well, you know, I couldn't help but think about when the movie Avatar came out. It was so popular. Did you notice that the Pope felt compelled to actually come out and make the statement, "Nature would never replace religion"? It was almost as if he was afraid of the popularity of the movie.
Could be. Well, I think he might be afraid of the popularity of a lot of things because he's not too popular.
Well, true. Very true.
They're making themselves less popular all the time.
Well, absolutely, especially, I mean, you know, with if nothing else, the the pedophilia, the anti-woman stuff.
The ill treatment of the nuns. I mean, that's stupid. I mean, they're the most social justice part of the church, and they're issuing statements of complete disrespect.
Absolutely. Well, you've also done some articles on the women priests, haven't you?
I've done some articles that talk about some of the issues between the women priest movement on the one hand, which is a particular movement in the Catholic Church of ordaining women priests, and the women's church movement, which is more of a kind of idea that we don't need this sort of priest-laity hierarchy. What we need is to really create feminist churches as communities. And so I've done some studies on that differences.
So what are your thoughts? I mean, do you think, I mean, I know there are a lot of very dedicated feminists and, you know, who are trying to change things from within. I mean, where do you stand? Are you on the inside trying to make change, or are you on the outside?
Well, I don't agree with their inside-outside boundaries to begin with. So, in other words, I don't believe in the boundaries that are defined by bishops and Pope. I believe in boundaries that are created, or communities that are created by the people. I'm more attracted to women's church myself, but I think there's also a place for the women priest movement.
Well,
I'm sort of suspicious of some tendencies to kind of sort of revalidate hierarchy.
So it's really, we ought to just tear it down and start all over rather than try to change it from within.
Well, I mean, my problem is the definition of within, the term within.
Because within means
so the Pope and the bishop define what's within rather than the people define what is church.
I see what you're saying.
As community.
Because if we change it from within, we're still stuck working with that hierarchy.
Right. The women's church movement has been a movement basically of lay people creating communities in which everybody is equal and works together.
Okay. Yeah, I think some of
setting up a kind of a priest-laity hierarchy.
I think some of the Unitarian Universalists do that too. They don't necessarily have a minister. Some of the lay people can actually run the church and do whatever it is they do.
Yeah, I think the Quakers have been good at that as well.
Okay. So let me ask you, Rosemary, I picked up and briefly read an article you had online called Creation Spirituality. Does that sort of, can that run peripheral to ecofeminism?
Well, I think creation spirituality would be really, for me anyway, a part of ecofeminism.
Could you talk about creation spirituality a little bit?
Well, creation spirituality is really a whole process in which you realize that the natural world has been here a lot longer than humans. Humans are a kind of very recent a blip in human history. They weren't given domination by God or anybody else. They sort of seized it for themselves, and that we need to find ways of really understanding that we are part of and a very latecomer part of the natural species of creation, and we need to find our way of being a part of nature rather than thinking that we dominate over it. So I think that's what ecofeminism is also. So I would say it's another way of talking about ecology and feminism.
Okay, all right. Now I had a couple people emailed me questions and wanted me to ask you some questions if you feel comfortable. One says they wanted to know what is your spirituality? Are you Christian? How do you worship? Is Christianity cultural, theoretical? How do you see it?
Well, I just talked about my spirituality, which is basically an ecological spirituality, and really to understand that we are part of the creation, and one species among others, and we need to kind of work with all of nature as our fellow creatures. creatures. So that's probably not what they're really asking about. What they want to ask about is what kind of denomination are you connected with?
Yeah, I guess they're looking for a label.
Right. I would say that I mean, I come out of a Christian tradition. I find and I'm very committed to really lifting up those aspects of Christianity that can be liberating at the same time questioning and criticizing those aspects that are creating domination. But I'm a Christian, shall we say, an ecumenical and interfaith Christian, because I do that kind of commitment to making a better Christianity sort of in dialogue with people from other traditions around the world. And I think that we have to work that way today.
Yeah,
rather than in kind of separate, mutually exclusive religious traditions.
Okay, that makes sense to me, too.
The theological school that I belong to, which is Claremont, is now an interfaith seminary.
Okay.
In other words, it has a Christian school. It also has a Jewish group, a Muslim group, Jains, Buddhists, and so on. So it's becoming an interfaith theological school, and I find that very exciting.
So they're training ministers to be interfaith ministers?
No, they're training people to be ministers in a whole range of traditions. In other words, there's a Jewish community training people, men and women, to be rabbis. There's Muslim group training women and men to be imams. There's Jains, there's Buddhists. In other words, you're training leaders across religions within the same theological school.
Oh, where that's different, because normally it might have just been all Christian or all Jew or all Buddhist,
right,
or whatever. I see.
So that would make for interesting
conversations at lunch, don't you think?
Well, not simply at lunch, but in the classroom.
No, I know. But all of that diversity, it would be, you know, so much food for thought, and it would be exciting.
Yeah.
Well,
it really means that the classes have to go on in a very different way.
Are all of these folks in the same classroom together?
Yeah, right.
Oh, okay. See, I wasn't quite grasping that. I figured they just had, they just had different classes with. So they're all learning about each other's spirituality.
So they're learning about each other, but they're also training people within each of these kind of traditions.
Okay. Okay. All right. That makes more sense to me now. I got an email here from someone who read your book, Goddesses and Divine Feminine, or was going to read it. I'm not sure exactly. I can't tell. they asked. It sounds like in the book you challenge the popular idea that some societies were matriarchal, governed by feminine divinity. I don't know if that's too big of a subject for you to answer, sort of in general terms, but they're wondering why you came to that conclusion.
I came to that conclusion because of historical evidence. In other words, I think there has been a kind of popular, simplistic notion, which goes back to the 19th century, of somehow that originally there were matriarchal societies and they were supplanted by patriarchal societies. And I think the historical evidence just shows that realities are much more complicated. There was probably much more of a kind of pattern most religions of the world are male and have gods and goddesses. I mean, those were the religions of antiquity. All had gods and goddesses, rather than a kind of shift from goddesses to gods.
So you're saying
and the goddesses did not completely disappear from Judaism and Christianity. There's always remained elements of the Sophia, feminine aspects of the divine.
So you think there was, it rather than a shift from goddess to god, I think some people call it that great reversal, you think there was more of an egalitarian society in the beginning and with male and female gods, and that sort of changed over time with the Abrahamic religions?
What I do in the book is try to show the complexity of this story, because by the time we get to historical evidence, what we have in the antiquity is religions of goddesses and gods, but those are by the time we get texts, goddesses and gods have now become a part of a kind of upper class of male and female kings and queens. They're not really egalitarian societies. And so what that might have been at an earlier stage would have to be researched, because we don't, that goes back before written sources. So my book is trying to show the complexity of the question.
Okay. And I would imagine, as far as Mary goes, I mean, do you agree that sort of the goddesses just sort of pass their baton on to Mary and she becomes the goddess in Christianity?
I think Mary becomes a kind of way of bringing the feminine presence in heaven into Christianity. Theologically, of course, they never accepted that she was a part of God. She's a sort of elevated human being. But I think the way in which she really functions popularly for people is, in fact, as a goddess.
Okay. Well, Rosemary, I so appreciate your time. I hope that you will maybe consider coming back and talking to us again on one of your other books.
Oh, sure. That would be fun.
Well, so before I let you go, though, and I want to read your bio, too. I usually do that in the beginning, but I got so excited and I wanted to jump into our chat. I'm going to read your bio. But I wanted to ask you, is there anything I haven't thought to ask you that you would like to share with listeners?
Well, I just think this is a very rich conversation, and there's so many different dimensions of it. That there would be plenty to talk about for several other programs.
Oh, I'm sure. All your different books. I mean, I'd love to hear more on your, theories of, egalitarian versus matriarchal or matrifocal societies.
Right.
Also, too, I think in that book there's something in there about the Aztec and Christian female symbols in Mexico, which would be very interesting.
Right. Right.
That just, forgive me, I have to ask, is Guadalupe, a lot of people say, well, that's sort of just Tononzin. And I realize that's, to a certain extent an oversimplification, but is that what you're talking about? Is that what you go into in Goddesses and Divine
Feminine?
Well,
I have a chapter on Guadalupe Tononzin, and of course, Guadalupe is a strong Marian figure that the Spanish brought with them from Spain. And then, of course, it suddenly appears as this revelation in what had been a kind of Nahuatl is earlier than Aztec, religious site. So it, in effect, it then functions to give a kind of way of carrying on that tradition for indigenous people. So it sort of has a bifurcation.
Okay. Well, I'm wondering, all of these apparitions that we have seen around the world, I know when the apparition appeared in Zetan, Egypt, the deity was in the eye of the beholder. You know, I read somewhere that the pagans thought it was Isis, the Christians thought it was Mary, the Muslims thought it was the Shekinah. These Our Ladies who have appeared. Have you written anything on that? I mean, how would you identify who that is? I mean, are you of the mind that it is a great divine feminine, Mary? Who?
I mainly really studied in depth the Mexican experience.
Ah, okay.
I haven't tried to talk about the whole world.
Okay. I wonder how you found time to do what you've done. Listeners, this lady is an author of 47 books. Where do you find the time, Rosemary?
It was just a little bit every day.
A little bit every day. Well, let me go ahead and read your bio. I just want to make sure everyone knows who we've been talking to for the last 45 minutes. Rosemary Radford Reuther, she received her B.A. in philosophy from Scripps College, her M.A. in Roman history from Claremont Graduate School, her Ph.D. in classics and patristics from Claremont Graduate University. She taught for 10 years from 65 to 75 at the School of Religion at Howard University at Washington, D.C., for 27 years at Garrett Theological Seminary and Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, from 75 to 2002, and for 5 years at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. She is presently a professor of feminist theology at Claremont School of Theology and the Claremont Graduate University in Claremont, California. She's authored 47 books, hundreds of articles on feminist theology, ecofeminism, and women in Christian history and thought and social justice. Wow, what a CV, Rosemary.
Right, and I'm still continuing.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what stokes your passion these days? What are you most, what do you like to teach about? What's your next book?
I'm interested in what you might call transnational feminism, how feminism really works across, not only across faith, but across cultures. And there has been a lot of misunderstanding, not misunderstanding, really appropriate critique by some African and other third world feminists of how Western feminism has been, kind of allied itself unthinkingly with Western colonialism and so on. And so I'm interested in how we get past that and really find ways to work together across cultures.
So, Rosemary, do you think feminism is alive and well, or do you think it's dormant?
Feminism is proliferating in many different forms across cultures and faith. And what I'm interested in is finding ways to really work together in positive ways rather than having feminism be sort of Western feminism be sort of allied with colonialism.
Maybe it's too soon to tell, but do you think the Republicans' recent shenanigans with the more than 900 bills trying to thwart women's access to contraception and abortion is going to just help stoke the fires of feminism?
Well, I think there needs to be more intelligent ways of communicating what's really going on. And I think that's where we have to figure out how to use the media better so that American people really understand better what's going on.
Well,
rather than having this ridiculous notion that somehow the bishops are defending religious freedom when they're really defending their religious freedom to oppress other people.
Right. Well, I've always said, the left just does not have a very good megaphone. We are just not the masters of spin that the right is. I don't know what's wrong with us. I mean, we have Hollywood, for heaven's sake. why don't the people in Hollywood that are so good at storytelling, we need to employ them to tell the other side.
Right.
Well, I'm kidding, but it does feel that way. It feels like the left just isn't passionate enough, to get out there. And I mean, we're not zealots, but the other side feels like zealots.
Right.
Maybe therein lies the difference. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe the left is in some ways too comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to have to get a lot worse before we're actually marching in the street by the millions.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Rosemary, thank you so very much. I will get in touch with you to come back on the show again, maybe in the fall.
Okay.
And we can chat about more stuff.
Okay. Well, this was a fun conversation.
Well, thank
Great.
You so much. It honors me that you think so. It'll be wonderful to have you back again.
Thank you for your work as a communicator.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Have a good weekend and good night.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed both of tonight's show, both guests on tonight's show. I sure enjoyed talking to both women. I just want to remind you before we go tonight that next week is our ritual on the radio, and we are going to be talking about pruning our divine tree, because it's that time of the year when you sort of take stock of the progress that you've made since January. You know, all of those seeds that you've planted are now sprouting, and maybe there's some dead branches on your tree that you have to prune so that the rest of the tree can flourish. Anyway, Samantha, one of the priestesses from Sacred Sunday, she's going to be back with me next Thursday, and we're going to chat about that. We have a wonderful meditation for you as well. We're going to talk about the idea of sacrifice. I remember when my mother used to tell me as a young girl, Karen, you have to sacrifice to be beautiful. I used to hear that all the time because she used to want me to put these bristle rollers in my hair and go to sleep with those things so I would look good in the morning, and I'd cry and whine and complain, and she'd say, you have to suffer to be beautiful. You have to sacrifice. So anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about some fun stuff like that and sort of put the idea of sacrifice, into context, because sacrifice can be a healthy thing that helps us actually flourish and grow stronger. You sacrifice or cut away, you prune, toxic people or bad habits and, things like that. So that's what we'll talk about next Thursday. So I want to thank you for tuning in tonight. As always, dear listeners, I love hearing from you. You are always gas in my tank. You keep me going, and you keep inspiring me to keep doing the show. It always seems like just when I wonder, if I should keep doing this, I'll get suddenly as if the universe knows I need a little jolt, I'll get emails from you saying, what a difference having the show makes. So thank you so very much. And I think I'm going to go ahead and end tonight's show with a new piece of music from one of my newer artists. And it feels appropriate to the message I offered at the beginning of the hour, that we all have to, awake and know what's going on. This is from Alea Deo. She was a recent guest. We talked about sacred music and meditation. This is a cut from one of her CDs, and it's called Awaken. Awaken. That's what we must all do, dear listeners. Awaken. So here goes, and please have a wonderful weekend, and keep tuning in. Thank you so very much for your time. Good night, and may Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Time.